Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Derek Davis, and we're going to continue our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. The fourth dimension. When I say the fourth dimension, where does your head go? Some strange old book you found in a dusty library, or a science fiction story, or some rock and roll band. In fact, now the fourth dimension seems a little passe. I mean, already in the Twilight Zone, they were talking about the fifth dimension, and now we read about superstring theory with its 11 dimensions, 10 dimensions of space and one dimension of time. So the fourth dimension, you know, seems maybe a little bit tired. But it's one of those concepts that, as our guest today proves in her wonderful book titled, unsurprisingly, The Fourth Dimension and Non-Euclidean Geometry, that the fourth dimension is one of those concepts that if you start, well, looking at it from multiple angles, you'll find that it carries within it a whole set of wonderful, fascinating, interwoven tales that really say a lot about the attempt over the last, say, 150 years to try to think, express, feel, intuit, and particularly paint our way outside of the three dimensions that we seem more or less stuck in, at least most of the time. Our guest today is Lyndall, and how do you say it? Pronounce your middle name there?
It's Dalrymple.
Dalrymple. Linda Dalrymple Henderson. That's a wonderful name. And again, her book, The Fourth Dimension in Non-Euclidean Geometry in Modern Art, came out many decades ago in its first edition, and it's just had a splashing new issue. And it's been a gas going through it in the sense that it interweaves the history of science, the history of modern art, and spirituality and occultism and mathematics, higher mathematics. So it's an incredibly rich weave that points to connections in our modern world that are often put into different kinds of categories. And it also really helps fill out something that I think is a great disappointment in how people often perceive so-called abstract art in the 20th century. I mean, you always remember when you're first a kid and you go on, you go, look at this thing, and you go, it's a square on a white background, and you're like, what is that? That's not art. And someone's, you know, and then you find out more about it, and people are often talking about the squareness. It's about the abstract shape of the square. And you're like, that's not that interesting. And then what you find out is that what a lot of the art theorists of the 20th century were not talking about for quite a long time, almost to the point of being as if there was a kind of conspiracy, is how many of the great abstractionists, particularly the early folks, were incredibly immersed in theosophy and mysticism and science fictional ideas about the fourth dimension of their work. These sort of abstract shapes and colors and relationships came out very richly from an intense engagement with the possibility of experiencing, understanding, and representing other dimensions. And they're not just playing with flat squares. And this book is just wonderful way of unpacking that. Not, it's a hidden story. It's less hidden than it used to be, but it's a really important dimension, particularly for listeners here on the show, where we so love to draw links between science, technique, consciousness, mysticism, culture. So I look forward to this conversation. Our co-host Majida will not be joining us this afternoon. I think she's reading astrological charts, which is good for whoever she's reading them for. So today it's just going to be you and I, Linda. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm delighted to have this conversation.
Yeah, really. And I've spent the last couple days going through your through your book, and it's really quite a gas. I mean, you do very well explaining scientific and mathematical ideas, as well as going into great, wonderful detail about the history of the concepts and of artists, many of whom I was not familiar with. And so it's been really wonderful. But I like the story you kind of tell at the beginning about how so many years ago you became fascinated with this concept, almost kind of stumbling into it at the card catalog at Yale. And I'd love it just maybe to give us a little sense of how the glimmerings of this, you know, this theme that would really come to play such an important role in your own work, how it sort of dawned on you that there was this interesting, rather hidden history behind this kind of curious concept of the fourth dimension.
Okay, well, it's a story of an assignment in a graduate seminar on a fateful day in February 1970 when the list of possible paper topics for a class on art, science, and technology was moving around the table in the class of Robert Herbert at Yale. And as the list went around, of course, it got shorter and shorter as people took topics. And I really wanted, I thought, the color theory topic, and the person next to me took that. So I took my second choice, which was Scientific Metaphors in Artists and Critics' Writings, 1900 to 1930. And the way he had come upon that topic, he was very astute observer of this critical writing going on in the 50s and 60s, even starting in the late 40s, of people trying to connect Einstein and Picasso, or relativity and cubism, to validate cubism in some way by arguing that indeed it embodied Einstein's theories, and that was happening because books on cubism were being reprinted in original texts being reprinted in the 40s, and here was this term, the fourth dimension. And so advocates of this idea, like a fellow named Paul Laporte, wrote articles and see the cubists talk about the fourth dimension. That means Picasso knew something about Einstein and space-time. So I went off to the library thinking I would establish just how it was this French painter or Spanish painter in Paris knew about the latest German physics, and went to the card catalog, and it is a great paper card catalog story of pulling out the drawer for fourth dimension and finding this entire other world that had nothing to do with Einstein or relativity. And happily, actually, I have to say, I slipped that little group of cards out, took them around the corner and Xeroxed them on the brand new Xerox machine there. I put them back in. But I had this record all these years of exactly what was in that drawer, and when it came time to write the reintroduction for this new edition of the book, it was very handy to go back and see just what I'd seen on that first view. But it was a very rich drawer with writings by Charles Howard Hinton and Claude Bragdon and Uspensky, Abbott's Flatland as well. And as I began to read this material, it just opened up that indeed there was another paradigm in the early, you know, probably first two decades of the century, and certainly the late 19th century, that was not a temporal fourth dimension. It was space.
Let's make this point really clear, because that was something that I had kind of intuited this difference. I've read through some of this material, but I never really quite, you know, faced up to the distinction in all of its, sort of glory until going through your book. Well, let's think. So the difference between the idea of the fourth dimension being time, which we associate with Einstein and relativity,
right,
and then a different concept of the fourth dimension that is spatial and geometric. How do those?
Right.
What's the relationship of those?
Well,
the
idea of a spatial fourth dimension grows out of n-dimensional geometry in the 19th century, and by the 1870s or 1880s, people are speculating on, you can certainly just add an n, you can add as many spatial dimensions as you want, but of this possible reality of a higher spatial fourth dimension, and a lot of, it's when Flatland appears in 1884 with its suggestion that we might be just as narrow-minded as those two-dimensional Flatlanders who refuse to accept the possibility of that they're embedded in a larger space, that we might be in exactly that same situation. And there's a strong renewal of idealist philosophy in the late 19th century, and Plato's cave is the perfect analogy that really these early advocates of higher dimensions seize upon, that again, like those prisoners staring at the wall in the shadows, believing that's true reality, that we might be just as limited in our view. And it's not really, if Einstein publishes special relativity in 1905, but that's known to a select group of scientists. It's really not known to the public, and it's not really until he becomes a superstar in 1919 with the Eclipse Expedition that supports his theory that he hits the big time or hits the mind of the public. So really from, say, 1880 to 1920, the dominant conception of the term fourth dimension is as space. And one of the things, as I didn't realize this when I wrote the initial dissertation and book, but as I came to work more on early 20th century science, I realized how much the discovery of the X-ray in 1895 had to do with this popularity of the fourth dimension. It might have really remained a rather obscure idea, but that proof that the human retina is just getting one narrow, you know, wavelength of light and blind to what else is going on really suggested that just because you couldn't see the fourth dimension, you certainly couldn't say it didn't exist.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a technological, replay of the basic idea in Plato's cave. I mean,
right.
What's so fascinating in retrospect is that just looking at the late 19th century, and which in so many ways is just kind of setting the foundation for the media technological explosion that we, you know, that we have. Obviously, we go through a very different mode with the computer, and we'll probably talk about computer graphics later in the show. But just looking at all of these different sciences, I mean, you can just feel the sense of, like, people have been living inside this nice, comfortable, three-dimensional thing that moves forward in time. And then suddenly, looking at mathematics, looking at new theories of electromagnetism, testing these fields, and then going into the realm of different frequencies and recognizing mm-hmm. that different frequencies can actually show you a different world, so that the physical example of the X-ray of seeing the skeleton in the hand is like there are different layers of reality that are associated with different vibrations. And, you know, so that's a remarkable thing that's happening in science and technology. And then at the same time, of course, you have this explosion of occultism and spirituality, the famous theosophists who are trying to kind of build their own descriptions of other dimensions of reality. And all of these different vectors, and we haven't even mentioned art, all of these different vectors are just pointing to the kind of fragility or the sense that there's something beyond the world that we're familiar with. So when you're looking, my question for you is, like, when you're looking at all of those different elements, how do you tend to see it? Do you tend to think that there's that science is driving the show, or that the human imagination is driving the show, or is it just a complicated interweave of all of these different elements in society, and math, and spirit, and art? How do you get a handle on it?
Right. Well, as I say, it was a fateful day in 1970 because I wrote that book and then have continued to work away on this topic along with other things, and it's been really a revelation to in part recovering the pre-relativity physics. I think one unfortunate thing, along with formalist art criticism and its dominance during so much of the 20th century, which did not want to really look at content, also this false sense that Einstein equals 20th century science, that E equals MC squared stands for the 20th century. And what that misses is the fact the first two decades are still dominated by ether physics, basically. And the ether did not die at the time of the Michelson-Morley experiment in the 1890s. It didn't go away in 1905. It's not until, you know, by 1919 or so that the general public hears any kind of challenges to the ether. And that, I think of the fourth dimension and the ether as these two counterparts and signs of what I call an invisible meta-reality that the public generally believes in, that there is a reality just beyond the reach of human vision. And I think this is why, indeed, artists step right into the fray, because it's so liberating to the imagination to be freed of Renaissance perspective, to be freed of the dominance of visible light, which in the history of art, that one little narrow wavelength of the spectrum dominates what artists do for centuries. And to suddenly have light downgraded and be interested in wireless telegraphy waves and other kinds of invisible vibrations opens up a very interesting challenge for artists, one that continues to appeal to artists today. So what we had lost really was this context, the scientific context of the early 20th century, when it was just assumed that Einstein was dominant as of 1905, and there was so much writing, again, as I say, about this supposed connection, whereas it's a very, very different world. And it's also this world of the ether and higher dimensions. It's also the world of modern writers. So Ezra Pound, for example, so interested in electromagnetism and the ether. These two things go hand in hand to suggest the importance of the imagination in grappling with this challenge.
Yeah, and not to mention the whole more popular fiction as well with science fiction, and you talk about H.G. Wells and how much science fiction in the middle of the century kept going, kept these the idea of the spatial fourth dimension going. I mean, it's like there's like this deeper intuition about this possibility of perception that we can actually represent, see, intuit these things mm-hmm. that on paper we shouldn't be able to do because we kind of have to step out of our zone. And that's the part that really I got really strongly through your book is, you know, to take cubism as an example. I think, most listeners are going to be familiar with seeing the famous images by Braque and Picasso of the flat slices of the newspaper and the table, mm-hmm. and you can kind of recognize it, but it's all the angles are off. And I used to always think of those as being mostly about multiple perspectives. It's just like you can look at the table with the coffee and the newspaper from over here, and you can move over 2 feet over there. What would it look like if you layered all of those visions and tried to sort of create a kind of different multi-perspectival map?
Yeah,
and that's cool. What I also got from your thing, and let me see if I get this correct, is that there's a sort of deeper attempt, maybe not in those paintings, but in other artworks that are attempting to kind of, that are using cubist language, is to also suggest the existence of objects, fourth-dimensional objects that can only be represented on a picture plane or in our world with these sort of slices. So there's actually something more than just multiple perspectives. It's that the object that is being depicted is itself, you know, fourth dimensional and outside of our normal ken.
Right. I think the notion of Renaissance perspective and a painting being a window on the world, I like to think of cubist paintings as a window on the invisible world that people are reading about. And again, the popular literature on this idea is incredible. One didn't have to be a scientist to be aware of this this idea, both popular scientific ideas and the fourth dimension. So you're right about the multiple perspectives, because in fact Henri Poincaré talks about if one were to try to represent a four-dimensional object, and this is in Science and Hypothesis in 1902, he says you could take multiple perspectives of it and combine them, and from that intuit something about the higher dimensional object. So we're looking at paintings that also are affected by the X-ray, and the transparency of the X-ray is the other thing that's going on here, so that we're getting multiple viewpoints, but they're fused in this kind of ethereal space in which objects no longer seem to have clear boundaries. And that's, I think, helps us so much in thinking about cubism, that not only the ether, but the discovery of radioactivity and the popularizers like Gustave Le Bon, who suggests that everything is radioactive and everything is emitting particles into the ether around it. And at the same time, from that ether, matter may be being born in what was called the electric theory of matter. So the notion, and it ties in with Bergson's philosophy too, that it's false to draw a clear boundary around something. So the sense of reality as flux, invisible vibrations, invisible particles, and higher dimensions, all of those things come together to make a really powerful argument against traditional naturalist painting or the use of three-dimensional perspective. So multiple perspectives are crucial in part of that rebellion of against past painting.
Sure. Well, but on one level, you could be describing this new electromagnetic world of visible vibrations, and what I think of, I think of music, and of course, musicians were influenced by these dialogues too. And you have a little bit of that in your book. But on the surface, it would seem like the worst place to be if you're interested in this realm of higher dimensions and very curious models of space. The worst thing to be doing would be facing a two-dimensional canvas with a bunch of paint.
I have to say, worse than that was to be a sculptor. Because on the canvas, you could, in fact, break down these boundaries and create very complex, fluctuating spaces that suggested some other kind of reality. Much, much harder to be a sculptor, because then you were dealing really with this very physical object that had edges. And the one artist who really succeeds in, I think, or fair, you know, comes closest to succeeding in denying the actual physicality or traditional boundaries of an object is the futurist Boccioni and his famous sculpture, Unique Forms of Continuity in Space, which is that striding bronze figure that has these extrusions at the back as if he were walking through water. He's leaving a trail, in a sense. So Boccioni, who's also a reader of Bergson, is very interested in suggesting this interconnection between matter and space, or
yeah,
the ether.
And that's an amazing piece too. I mean, that's at the MoMA, and I remember, you know, going hanging out with that many times. And people are listening who haven't seen it should just go grab a Google image right now, because it's very sci-fi as well. It's got a really interesting kind of. In fact, I'm sort of surprised that someone hasn't tried to sample that for some kind of the costumes of some.
The head of the figure, I always say to my students, it's very Darth Vader-like, a sort of helmet-like head.
Exactly. Well, here's a question for you. So when we think about it, particularly the early wave of abstractionists who were trying to depict these new spaces in different ways, with, you know, being influenced by different ideas in mathematics and physics and other things like theosophy or whatever. Again, because we tend to think of these guys as being very formalist, very intellectual, they're just playing with abstract shapes, but actually they're motivated by much more intense emotional kinds of goals and aspirations. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, in a way, like, you know, one of your favorite guys, whether it's Duchamp or Kandinsky or one of the better known artists, and just give us a little bit more sense of what that interior motivation based on these mathematical inspirations, what that felt like for them.
Okay, well, I'll talk a little bit about Malevich and the Russian suprematist, who's the one reading Uspensky and seeking mystical higher consciousness in his paintings, and then come back to Duchamp, because he's equally interested in the idea, but from a much more strictly geometrical point of view. And that is one of the things, I think, that makes this concept so appealing and lasting, is that it spans this range from geometry, you know, to ether connections to ether physics and the ether, mystical higher consciousness, science fiction, science, outer space. By the 1960s, it's being linked to outer space. So just to go back, you mentioned theosophy earlier, and in fact, I think one of the things that makes theosophy so appealing to artists like Kandinsky or Mondrian in this period is that the theosophists are absolutely in tune with the new ether physics. So Blavatsky in Isis Unveiled in 1888 is already tying theosophical doctrines, the new theosophical, you know, philosophical worldview, with contemporary science, and she's drawing on William Crookes. Ultimately, Oliver Lodge becomes one of the great sources for theosophists like C.W. Ledbetter. And we've lost that. I mean, in losing this early 20th century paradigm, we've lost that connection with what theosophy meant at that moment, which was a very progressive way of, and very much in tune with thinking about the nature of reality in connection to both the fourth dimension and the ether, in the same way that we've lost this awareness that painters who, the first abstract painters, didn't do this on a lark, or for, as you say, for formalist purposes, but these were really, this was life philosophy, and Kandinsky, who publishes his book on the spiritual and art, really wants to make a spiritual painting that is anti-materialist, and that means suppressing the matter and the objects. And in the end, the ether is very important for him. He talks about setting up vibrations in the soul of the viewer. And on the model of wireless telegraphy and telepathy, he really believed that off that canvas could come some kind of vibratory communication that would transfer thought to a viewer, hit them where they live, essentially. These paintings are meant to be transformative. They really are meant to come off the canvas and change.
You know, it's funny when you say that, this whole idea of the painting as a portal, and particularly with Malevich, a Russian fellow. I think simultaneously I go back in time to icon painting, where icons are very highly geometrically formalized portals into the other world, and on the other direction, I go forward to an artist I know we both love very much, Paul Laffoley, whose wonderful diagrams, though they're not attempting to sort of represent the dimension exactly, although some of them do. They're more like mandalas of concepts, diagrams, blueprints.
Right.
But they are also images that are very intentionally, some of them very intentionally designed as portals to affect you standing there in the hall or wherever you are. And it's a marvelous, you know, it's a way of viewing work or of understanding what the intention of art can be and what it is for many artists that we don't have enough of in
right.
our world. I mean, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of ranting here, but this is like a personal thing. I really think everyone should go into a museum. Don't put your intellect at the door, but go in there with the assumption or the game that these are all potential portals, and you don't know where they're going to take you. And it's much more fun that way. And when you read some of these great icons of the most important artwork of the 20th century, that they were motivated by something much more intense and intimate and crazy sometimes, in a good sense.
Visionary, certainly, yeah.
Visionary, that's the word. That's the good word to use. So it makes sense.
Your icon analogy is a perfect one, because both Kandinsky and Malevich are Russians. They grow up with the icon tradition, and that notion of the icon is a kind of communication device that's ferrying worship and blessings through this object. That's certainly another model for Kandinsky, but it's a particularly good model for Malevich, who is the painter of the famous black square on a white background in 1915, along with a number of the other kind of geometric works you were alluding to that tend to have a white infinite space with these geometric forms floating in it, in that space. When he had his first exhibition in December of 1915, he mounted the black square up in the corner of the room, the way we might see a loudspeaker mounted, but really in the traditional spot of the Russian icon in a Russian home, suggesting that this was kind of the icon of a new kind of painting, a new possibility for painting. And as I mentioned Uspensky earlier, P.D. Uspensky's book of 1911, Tertium Organum, a crucial source for Malevich and his Russian colleagues, and Uspensky is drawing upon Charles Howard Hinton, who's the first real philosopher of hyperspace, I like to call him, arguing indeed for the limitation of human perception, and absolutely convinced that the fourth dimension exists and that one can achieve cosmic consciousness and experience the fourth dimension. And he even has a little system of illogical logic, he argues, you can practice to speed along this progress by getting rid of your sense in left and right and gravity up and down, but also the just an inverted logic to liberate your mind from this false three-dimensional logic of the world. So Malevich and these paintings, these are also meant to be transformative. He's reading Uspensky, and Uspensky describes this moment when one might achieve this sense of the vast, infinite space of the fourth dimension. And Malevich, in so many ways, seems to be trying to give form to a space that's not the blue sky. It's a white space on which, in some, like the black square, in some of the paintings, there's a monochromatic field of shapes that suggests three-dimensional forms passing through a two-dimensional plane, like Flatland. He calls these, subtitles these color masses in the second dimension. And then the group of multicolored paintings with planes floating, overlapping, much more dynamic, this sense of movement in some way, he subtitles these color masses of the fourth dimension. And I think he really hoped this painting, and certainly if we go back to 1915, it would be like something no one had ever seen, a sense of a new kind of gravity-free, infinite space. He's interested in airplanes and space travel, rocketry, and that certainly is some technology that's feeding into this.
I mean, I think it's an equivalent would be now if you went into a three-dimensional digital display environment at some lab in Silicon Valley, and they're trying to model like 11-dimension superstring structures, but doing it in an artistic way. I mean, it had that kind of aspiration to really break through and let something else happen. But we got to take a break right here. So
okay. You're
listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Linda Henderson about the fourth dimension, and we'll be right back. Welcome back
to
Expanding Mind. Eric Davis here talking with Linda Henderson about the fourth dimension. Now, we were just talking about Uspensky before, a very important 20th century mystic character, spent some time with Gurdjieff and gave us some of the better or at least clearer writings on some of the Gurdjieff work that we have, although he later broke with him. But one of the ideas that you had, that you mentioned there, that I think is really key, is that just in the way that we can sit down with a book like Flatland and really try to build this understanding of how the world would work for two-dimensional creatures encountering a three-dimensional object, and it would have these strange properties. And then we can use that as an analogy to imagine our three-dimensional world encountering a fourth-dimensional object, which many people use that text to do, and a variety of other things to actually try to think our way using our reason and our intuition, our sense of space, our sense of how things fold and how things curve. But we can do this with our minds, with art, with mathematics, with geometry, and in so doing, we are actually changing our consciousness that enables us to slip out of ordinary imprisoned reality in three dimensions and actually encounter another dimension of existence. So that's the big claim. That's the crazy idea. And I think everyone can have some sense of why people might think that when you do study these things and suddenly you get a flash and you go, I understand how a tesseract would sort of unfold through space. And there's a sense of like opening up another kind of element of mind. I'm not going to say it's another dimension of reality, but you can understand the appeal of these things, which is, I think, one reason that many people who aren't trained as mathematicians or geometers get fascinated with this stuff and really want to think about it, because you can still get this kind of opening. And you have spent decades hanging around the fourth dimension in all of these domains, reading everything you can get your hands on, science fiction stories, mathematical treaties, crazy artist rants. They use the term again, visionary artist rants from, the 40s or whatever. How has hanging around the idea for so long changed you? Like, how have you come to feel this question of another dimension or what these kinds of concepts can do for someone if you're really thinking them through and intuiting them robustly?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the for me, I've come to feel that, and I find this to be so true, that any artist who's interested in the fourth dimension is someone with whom I feel very sympathetic, and there is a sense of just generally the existence of this interest as a sign of a freedom of imagination. That's, you know, exactly the kind of work that you do in terms of your technosis, for example. And so I don't know that I think the closest I've come to experiencing this magic, actually, was with this leap that comes with computer graphics and the work that Tom Banchoff did in 1978, when he made in a very large computer this film, the Hypercube Projections and Slicings at Brown University. And there we see magically, and this is, I mean, something that is so remarkable about a rotating four-dimensional hypercube. So the hypercube, the equivalent of the cube, but with made up of eight cubes, a cube itself bounded by cubes, containing, and this is the mind-blowing part, an infinity of cubes within it, just the way a cube contains an infinity of planes. We generate that cube by moving, but we don't count the number of planes. Same thing to generate a hypercube. We would move a cube off into four-dimensional, in the direction of the fourth dimension, and it would leave this trace and contain an infinity of cubes. And when Banchoff was making this film, he used what Michael Knoll actually had done at Bell Labs in the 60s, also a very preliminary version of such a thing that was meant to be stereographic, and you had to kind of cross your eyes as you were looking at these two sets of frames. But that, he uses the basic symbol of the hypercube as a cube within a cube with each of the vertices connected. And the magic of that rotation mathematically, where this thing actually turns itself inside out, so the inside cube ultimately, as it rotates, it wraps around the outside cube, is fantastic. It's just a reminder of the complexity of this and what computer graphics can do. And I was going to mention, we were talking about Milievich, and a great admirer of Milievich is Marcus Novak, this digital architect who's at Santa Barbara, who does now what Milievich dreamed of doing, which is to put you in an environment with a mounted helmet in which you navigate this vast, infinite, orientationless space, and he fills it with, oftentimes with geometrical forms that are homages in some way to Milievich. But this, I guess, it's in, I think using Marcus's helmet then for me was, I needed a little technological help, I have to confess.
Yeah, but that makes total sense. I mean, it's also partly, it's again this idea of a portal, you know, an interactive artwork, in the, to use a kind of overused term, but one in which you are immersed and must sort of make your way around, reconstruct from the inside, that is in a way an extension of that same idea that something can actually happen,
yes,
in the engagement with the piece, and it's not just something to think about or reflect or analyze after the fact. Yeah, it was wonderful to read about Novak's work in your book, because I was familiar with his stuff because he did the cyberspace book back in the day, and you talk about cyberspace as this important, you know, it's a funny term for us now, and we don't really think of it spatially the way that it had, that it was thought of for a while. But back in the 90s, there was this really sort of almost utopian period when people were sort of imagining the different ways that this, you know, this apparently spatial thing, or this realm that had a spatial dimension, could be reconfigured, mm-hmm, and that could be a possible site for all sorts of,
yes,
investigations. And it was sort of touching. You know?
It was. It was a beautiful vision. That's right.
You know, in our grim days of, you know, NSA snooping, and you know, everybody's got, you know, their smartphones everywhere. It's like to have a little a hint of that kind of higher dimension, but it is partly about being able to have those experiences directly. I mean, when I read about the That early IBM film, I just went on YouTube and they have it, the one from the 60s, where you got to cross your eyes a little bit. But as soon as you cross your eyes right, it's pretty good, you know? And I'm like, and it pops out and there's this sense of kind of something shifting inside you as you gain that extra dimension. So
And what's remarkable now is the number of wonderful computer animations of hypercubes doing this and that. There is even a cell phone app that's Hypercube or Tesseract, one of those. So I am struck by students now being so much more attuned to the spatial fourth dimension than they were, 10 years ago even, certainly 15 or 20 years ago. And one of the things, not only computer graphics, but you mentioned string theory earlier, and in my sort of looking at the course of this idea, the fate of this idea through the century, there is this dominance of relativity and time as the fourth dimension from the 20s, I'd say, through the 70s, with a bit of a renewal in the 60s, thanks to Martin Gardner writing in Scientific American about the idea. And there's a little percolation up of the idea in the 60s, and certain artists get interested in it. But it's really the coming of string theory in the early 80s, and this popularization of a scientific idea of higher dimensional space, seemingly now valid again in the context of science, that just explodes in terms of growing interest in this and awareness of this idea again. And you mentioned the Twilight Zone, and it's so interesting that both Rod Serling and Madeline L'Engle in A Wrinkle in Time had to go to the fifth dimension to get the magic, because in the middle of the century, the term fourth dimension was kind of used up as time. And to get to suggest some kind of spatial change, one had to go up, although L'Engle uses tessering, as in the tesseract, talks about the tesseract, but she stays away from using the term fourth dimension in the book because its general cultural reputation is so purely time.
Yeah, it's funny. I even remember being a kid and thinking about the fourth dimension and going, wow, and I don't remember where the idea came. This is in the 70s. Going, wow, the fourth, another dimension, how does that work? And then someone was like, yeah, it's time. And then I was like, oh, that's all? Like, I mean, okay.
That is so
like a movie then. Whatever.
Dampen the enthusiasm or the possibility with that much simpler idea of what it could be.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about string theory. That was another thing in your book that I also did, how – it's one of those wonderful books where what it reminds me of, excuse the extended analogy, is that I love visiting cities I don't know very well and kind of wandering around. And one of the experiences that I particularly love is like I kind of know this one area over here and I know this other area over here. And then I wander maybe the fourth or fifth time. I see how they're connected. And suddenly my whole map of the space has more dimension to it. And your book's like that. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's where the string theory fits in with this mystical return and the computer animation. It's really wonderful. But one of the things I got from that is that before string theory really started to, gain traction, that physicists just weren't even messing around with that stuff. They weren't going into weird n-dimensional space to try to explain things. They were really trying to stick with, a lot of big, hairy problems, and quantum physics is very peculiar, but they weren't invoking these higher spatial dimensions as a way of explaining the math and the problems that they were encountering. So it's really quite a radical shift in terms of the official scientific resurrection of this sense of a spatial higher dimension.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so true. And this book I certainly relied on in writing this, Paul Halpern's book, The Great Beyond, is such a wonderful history of string theory and really resurrects Kaluza and Klein, the two physicists who immediately after the emergence of relativity were thinking about an extra spatial dimension to help solve some of the problems Einstein was having. And I think the great surprise is that into the 1930s, Einstein himself was still flirting with this possibility of an extra spatial dimension. And that to me was the biggest revelation, because it seemed you know, this story was an open and shut case, and it became time in the space-time continuum that Minkowski had posited in 1908 and Einstein adopted, and that was end of story. And indeed, and this is where the string theorists went back to Kaluza and Klein and found interesting possibilities that opened up these new avenues. So I have to say it's a graduate student's dream to write a dissertation in 1975, finish up in 75 on this topic that was seemed so obscure. And I'd say, oh, I'm writing on the fourth dimension. Everyone, of course, thought it was time. And I'd have to say, no, it's this quaint idea from the early 20th century. and so I've most of all have enjoyed this renewal of this notion and so much more general interest in it.
Well, what has come along with that? I mean, you mentioned that, neither of us are physicists here, diving too much into the string theory itself is probably, to be advised against. But that in terms of understanding and seeing with your lens, with your appreciation for how these ideas influenced culture and consciousness 100 years ago, what is your sense now of like string theory as it sort of as it's moved through the larger popular consciousness, through popular science writing, through the New Age, through computer graphics? Like, how is it serving a similar function, or are things different now?
Well, I think I certainly feel this as an art historian that in somehow getting into the 21st century opens a lot of people up to aspects of the 20th century that were kind of suppressed somehow, including, as we've said, this actually a visionary tradition of painting that if one looks more closely, you can see actually extends through the whole century. You would never, and I would put Paul Laffoley in that tradition, back with Malevich, et cetera, at the beginning. And there just seems to be such a greater openness to an artist interested in the spiritual. Occultism, expanded consciousness, again, that already starts in the 90s, but that certainly had not been so characteristic of the art world in before that point. So I think just in society in general, and I'm sure you are more aware of this than I in terms of cultural trends and interested in expanding minds, there, yeah. It's very, very welcome. I think what there was this sense from the 20s through the 80s, into the 80s, I'd say, that physics was within one equation to just nailing it all down. And to hear physicists talk about dark matter and dark energy and say they don't really know what they are, it's incredibly liberating. And I think that's this mood from the discovery of the black hole onward, or first positing of the black hole. I know for Paul Laffoley that was an extremely liberating thing which undercut that confidence in a sense of just about everything being defined in some absolute way.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing now and just how freewheeling physicists are sort of allowed or allowing themselves to be, in contrast with certainly the 1960s and the 70s. It mm-hmm. just starts cracking open in terms of, imagining time travel, wormholes, how this might be, how you might work them out, and developing these very bizarre mathematical systems, because you don't really know that bizarre mathematical system might actually be the one that ends mm-hmm. up having, data to support it, and we don't really know. So let's just explore the crazy maths and no longer think that we can know in advance what's going on. But I want to underline something that you said that I think is really key about our moment, which is so hard to get a handle on. I mean, I think maybe it's always hard to get a handle on the moment you're actually living through, but ours is so peculiar and bizarre. But one of the things that is happening is that we're looking back at the 20th century, which is so well documented, so well recorded. There's such an incredible archive. And we're almost changing our story or expanding our story in retrospect.
Yes.
So that in this example, the dominant story about abstract art, such an important part of the 20th century, as this largely formalist gesture, it has so much to do with the new, with the break, with any sort of tradition or supernaturalism or anything like that. And now you we can look back and recognize that there's a tremendous amount of spirituality and metaphysics and consciousness exploration absolutely infusing the whole scene, plus all these artists that didn't get their due back in the day now become more important because they resonate with where we're at. So someone like Paul Laffoley, you know, when I first saw him in the 90s, you know, he was a cult. That was something that only weirdos liked. You had to be a freak to like that stuff. And nobody else knew about it or wanted to talk about it. And now people can go, hey, no, this is some serious art here. We have to really struggle with that. And I think it's a wonderful thing about our moment. And actually, I find more encouraging sometimes than the things that are happening now is the way in which we're reconstructing, telling a different story about how we got here through the tremendous archive of the 20th century.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, it seems to me that we need to rewrite the history of art for the first two decades of the century with both the spatial fourth dimension, but the ether as well. I mean, that's the other big lacuna in scholars' knowledge. And indeed, it's the reigning paradigm that space is not empty, but filled with this marvelous, mysterious, impalpable thing, the ether, through which all those waves are vibrating. And you look at Cubist paintings in that context, and they suddenly make sense. Picasso and Braque considered themselves realist painters. It's just it was a very different reality. We kind of lost.
That's wonderful. On that note, we got to get him on the show sometime. But Joe Milutis,
I know Joe.
Oh yeah, we got to get him on. We keep exchanging emails and dropping the dates. But yeah, he's a Laffoley fan as well.
Yes, exactly right.
So what are you working on now? Are you continuing to work on this material? You have a book that's going to be looking more at the contemporary versions of this.
What I'm actually doing is the new edition of the Fourth Dimension book has a 100-page reintroduction that recovers some of the scientific background or connections for the Fourth Dimension that I didn't know when I wrote the original book, and then tracks it, gives a sampling of its presence from 1950 to 2000, so picks up on those artists in the 60s, for example, Robert Smithson or the Park Place Gallery group, who were deeply engaged with this idea, but that notion just was not talked about in critical writing and in this period, and a little confusing for most of the public who were still thinking that the fourth dimension was time. So there's a sampling of that and the pickup of the computer graphics and string theory, but I have to confess, I spent about 8 years in the 2000s researching, just sort of following leads and discovering, indeed, that this wasn't, original book ended in the 40s, and I thought the spatial fourth dimension was definitively dead by that point with the triumph of space-time. And then to discover, indeed, as you mentioned earlier, it was very much alive in science fiction, and certainly in mystical literature, there were diehards remaining loyal to this notion. And then Martin Gardner in 1957, when he starts his Scientific American column, starts writing about the fourth dimension. And then Dover Books is reprinting some of the early 20th century books, the works of Dover doesn't reprint Bragdon, but Bragdon is soon being recovered as well. And there is an amazing sort of small surging up in the 60s, as I mentioned. And Uspensky is, everybody's reading Uspensky in the 60s. The resonances are so strong, I think, between the teens and the 60s. So there is certainly something of a revival there, and then it really comes along in the 80s.
We got to wrap it up really shortly here, so I just want to give you time to let people know, other than seeking out your book, if there's any place online that you have other articles or places that people could find out more about what you're working on.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't have a lot of material online, although my webpage at the university has my publications. And so I'm just carrying forward, going to do a second fourth dimension book that looks decade by decade through the century, because it changes its meaning so each decade that it's a really rich leitmotif of the 20th century, of the entire century.
Well, wonderful. Linda, thanks so much for being on the show. This is a real treat.
Well, great treat for me. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. To all you out there, keep your minds open.